Again, a striking parallel. One from the 7th century, the other one 1,000 years later. Different continents. No reason to believe they had any contact with each other, let alone the lapse in time. But they weren't sending scouts back and forth, and they didn't have the internet. They did not blazing trails back and forth between Mount Athos and Lhasa, saying, "What have you guys discovered now?" So when they come, this really strikes me with my scientific background. It gets kind of exciting. The plot is getting more and more interesting here. That it's not just one little thing there and one little thing there that you can say, "Well, coincidence." Once you have people meditating for 1,000, 2,000 years, they're bound to come up with something in common. But it's more than just a something. There are whole sequences of practices, which makes me think that despite the very important differences in, let's say, the Judeo-Christian worldview, or the Jewish and then the Christian worldview and the Buddhist worldview, I mean, there are really differences. Here, these commonalities are not trivial. I mean, we're dealing with core practices here, core to each one developed independently. From a scientific perspective, that's really interesting. When you have laboratories that do not communicate with each other, develop similar strategies and come to very similar, if not identical, conclusions, then from scientifically, here's how you would phrase this, what they're discovering are probably not artifacts of their method of inquiry. Now, this is one of the things that contemplative traditions are known for, condemned for, and that is you become a monk in any tradition, or a swami, or a sadhu, or what have you, and you're told all the right answers at the beginning. Your priest, your roshi, your lama, your meditation master tells you, okay, now here's what I want you to realize. This is what you should do. Now memorize all the right answers, okay? Now start reciting this mantra and do this, but this is what you're going to find. And so are you ready to find it? Because this is what you're going to find. And everybody gets brainwashed and winds up, of course, confirming and pleasing their teachers, you know? And then the whole notion of contemplative inquiry becomes a joke. Because it's basically brainwashing that then for which we get some kind of a contemplative affirmation of what we are led to believe was the case already. But this type of statement, clearly he does say this is going to happen. I don't think this is brainwashing. I think this is an account from the front lines. This is what happens when you do the practice. And I think they did it independently, despite the very big differences in the worldview, which is the launching pad for these practices. Let's go to this practice, this very sublime practice of just awareness of awareness in which you're not directing your attention to any object at all, but just resting your awareness in its own nature, being aware of awareness. St. Simeon, now we go to the 11th century. He said, after withdrawing your awareness from all worldly concerns, so again, now we're disengaging from the physical senses, we're disengaging from the pursuit of hedonic pleasures, still banking on, you know, somehow somebody out there, something out there is going to make me happy. Given up on that, when it's become disillusioned, has gotten real and recognized, well, that's not the source of well-being out there. After withdrawing awareness from all worldly concerns, focus your attention on your heart. He's actually referring to the physical heart. To start with, you will find there darkness and an impenetrable density. You just look within, actually into this space, this region of space within the field of the body. And you attend there, of course, with a mind's eye. Later, when you persist and practice this task day and night, and these people were pretty intense. Again, some spent 10, 20, 30 years in solitude doing this for hour after hour, day after day. So these were professionals. When you persist and practice this task day and night, you will find, as though miraculously, an unceasing joy. And that is a surprise, because you're not attending to pleasurable stimuli. For as soon as the intellect attains the place of the heart, and what's happening here is your awareness, by focusing on the heart, you're drawing your awareness, which normally we have a sense of being located up here, maybe behind the eyeballs. You're actually like putting your awareness, the locus of your attention, in an elevator. And you're hitting not ground floor, you're not going down to the soles of your feet, but you're going down a couple of floors, from up here down to the throat and down right here. You're actually moving the very locus of your sense of where you are, of your awareness. Where are you looking out from? Up here, that's where your psyche is located, if we wanted to give it a spatial place. But we're withdrawing it down to a deeper place. It's home here, in the center of the chest. You find an unceasing joy, for as soon as the intellect attains the place of the heart, the locus of your awareness has now come to rest at the heart. At once it sees things of which it previously knew nothing. It's like you're seeing from, it is. You are, in fact, seeing, perceiving from a different vantage point. No longer out of the nexus of your intellect, your ordinary psyche, you're actually perceiving, experiencing from a different vantage point. It sees the open space within the heart, and it beholds itself entirely luminous and full of discrimination. Luminous and full of discrimination. I'm just now reading that as if for the first time. Your awareness sees itself entirely. And it sees itself entirely as luminous. That is, this is one of the distinctive features of the awareness that you're now apprehending, awareness aware of itself. Luminous, but it's not just a luminous or clear quality, but it's full of discrimination. Discrimination means a quality of knowing, of discerning, of recognizing. It just struck me when I was reading that right now, that in Buddhism, the very definition of consciousness or awareness is in Tibetan called Selching Rigpa, luminous and knowing. That just occurred to me. Maybe that actually is the definition of consciousness. When the Christians did it in the 11th century, independent laboratories, and saying when you fathom the nature of awareness, when awareness turns its attention away from all objects, sensory, mental, images, turns itself away from the psyche, turns itself right in upon kind of just fundamental, basic, essential awareness and takes only that as its area, as its locus of interest, then you're seeing awareness nakedly. And then you see what are the defining characteristics, the salient characteristics of awareness itself. And the Saint Simeon said, luminous and discriminating. And the Buddhists say, no, we disagree. It's luminous and knowing. Quite interesting. They must be identifying the same phenomenon when they identify two salient defining characteristics and say, now when you know it wholly, when you have fathomed the nature of awareness, has two qualities. And this is phenomenological. Brain scientists and other people I've met, I meet a lot of people grappling with the issue of consciousness, just about invariably, they define consciousness nowadays in the scientific arena, they define consciousness in terms of something it's not. Whether it's 40 hertz, you know, a certain frequency of electromagnetic fields generated by the brain, that was one good college try, or they'll find other neuronal activities, global synchronous activities of the brain. Some identified it with behavior, some identify it with language skills. All of these are very well, but they're not awareness. They're simply seeing somehow related more or less to awareness. The contemplatives are the ones who for centuries have been attending to the phenomenon itself. They are the true natural scientists. If a natural scientist of any domain is one who is placing a primary emphasis on actually observing the phenomenon to be understood as meticulously, as rigorously as possible. The contemplatives are the greatest scientists of the mind that history has ever seen, because they alone, for centuries, have been training themselves for decade after decade, even in one single lifetime, to observe the phenomena themselves, to observe awareness itself by looking at it and not looking at the much easier to observe neural correlates, behavioral correlates, verbal expressions, piece of cake. These contemplatives are doing the hard work. And lo and behold, here it is. They're identifying the very definition or defining characteristics of awareness, and it's the same ones that the Buddhists discovered, I think quite independently. So we'll go over to the other side. Here we have 8th century. So this is a bit earlier. The last one was 11th century, so something like 300 years earlier, Padmasambhava, a great Indian adept, great contemplative, taught widely in Tibet, was seminal for bringing Buddhism, Indian Buddhism, to Tibet. Here's his essential instructions on this practice. Having nothing on which to meditate, that is to say, don't bring any appearance to mind, don't specifically or deliberately focus on anything that is appearing to the mind, having nothing on which to meditate, and without any modification or adulteration, don't try to do something to your mind, cultivate a certain mental state or flavor it or configure it in any way. just let your mind completely rest. Without any modification or adulteration, place your mind simply without wavering in its own natural state, its natural limpidity, which means luminosity and transparency. Place it in its own character just as it is. In other words, let your awareness just rest right where it already was before it got launched, before we pay attention to something, before we direct it somewhere, like an arrow. Before the arrow is launched out to something, awareness was already there. Let it stay home. And simply with unwavering mindfulness, just let the awareness illuminate its own nature, just as it is. Remain in clarity, clarity being the very nature of awareness, and rest the mind so that it is loose and free. So that's absolutely essential aspect of this practice. You can't do it while you're uptight. And then occasionally inquire, what is that awareness of the one who is focusing the interest? So a deeper inversion, that is, you are focusing your interest away from all the objects of the mind, right into the nature of awareness itself. What is the awareness of the one who is focusing the interest? And so invert deeply into this, what Nicholas of Cusa called this interiority. Go probe deeply into this interiority. Let the awareness itself steadily observe itself. At times, let your mind come to rest in the center of your heart. Yeah, that's right. In your heart. What's up with the heart? In the center of the heart, here in the center of the chest, just let the locus of your awareness settle. It's almost as if it's held up here in the head. That is our experiential sense of where our awareness is located. It's as if it's held up here by grasping. Grasping onto thoughts, emotions, all our senses tend to be located in the head. Here's one, here's another. 4 out of 5 are all in the head. Of course, there's some tactile up there too. And so releasing the grasping there, releasing the thoughts that tend to be up here, releasing it, and almost like going to free fall, the awareness has a sense of descending from the level of the head and coming settling in the heart. Let your mind come to rest in the center of your heart and evenly leave it there. At times, evenly focus in the expanse of the sky and leave it there. Thus, by shifting the gaze in various alternating ways, the mind settles in its natural state. And that is, it settles out of the mode of the psyche and descends into a more elemental, fundamental state of simple awareness, the deep interiority of the mind.